Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Ruth Ozeki's latest, The Book of Form and Emptiness, is a brilliantly inventive novel about loss, growing up, and our relationship with stuff. Benny is a 13-year-old boy who hears the voices of objects all around him. His mother is drowning in her possessions, and then he meets his very own book, a talking thing, who narrates Benny's life and teaches him to listen to the things that truly matter. Ruth Ozeki is a novelist, filmmaker, and Zen Buddhist priest. She is the award-winning author of three novels, My Year of Meats, All Over Creation, and A Tale for the Time Being. That was a finalist for the 2013 Booker Prize. She teaches creative writing at Smith College. Again, her new novel is The Book of Form and Emptiness, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Ruth Ozeki to this week's book show.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's wonderful to be here.
I so enjoyed this book and its beauty and ultimately the joy that comes from it. And yet it is, there is an inherent sadness to it because of these characters. I'm interested in what brought you to sort of that mood.
I think to some extent, you know, it's an artist's job or a writer's job to kind of tune into the zeitgeist. And it feels to me like we've been in a sad mood for, you know, a while now.
Right.
And I think I was just responding to that, you know. I think I was responding to my own confusion about reality, you know, in the past 6 years. You know, every time I turned on the news, I kept thinking, is this real? Could this be really real? You know, and Annabelle, of course, is a media monitor. So Annabelle, Benny's mother, is a media monitor. She listens to the news a lot. And so, you know, I think that my question kind of, informed this, you know, the sections, her scenes. And then, too, though, I was also, you know, I think there was a kind of disruption in what I thought was the status quo in our country. And so it, you know, this also started me questioning, you know, what is normal? And I think that the book is an attempt to, you know, attempt for me anyway, it's my attempt to try to answer some of these questions.
On that subject, let's talk about Benny, who is diagnosed with a mental disorder because the things around him are talking to him. He is hearing voices. What led you to explore that idea of people hearing voices?
So it started with a personal experience. After my father died, maybe for about a year or so after, I would from time to time hear his voice speaking my name. And I'd be doing something, you know, fairly common, fairly random, you know, just washing the dishes or folding the laundry or something like that. And I'd hear him as though he were standing behind me, and he would clear his throat and he would say my name. This was such a familiar sound, you know, this was such a familiar voice. And I would, you know, without thinking, I would just kind of turn around and look for him, and of course wouldn't see him because, you know, he had passed on. He wasn't there. He was dead. And every time this happened, I'd have a kind of, well, first of all, I would feel that sense of loss and grief, you know, sort of all over again. But there was also this feeling of like, what just happened? That wasn't real. That couldn't be real. Because it seemed so odd, I just would sort of repress it and forget about it and go on. And so in any case, this happened, I think, I would say probably about half a dozen times over the next year. And then little by little, it just sort of stopped. And then I guess it was at a book event. It was at a library reading that I was doing at a public library. I was talking about how fictional characters come to me as voices. And somebody from the audience asked me if when I, you know, spoke about that, did I mean, you know, voices that I could hear with my ear as though they were outside my body? Or were they more like voices that I heard with my mind inside, you know? And so, you know, I understood what he was talking about. And I said that, you know, in creative situations, yes, their voice is inside, you know, and I hear them with my mind, but that I understood what he was talking about, you know, this experience of hearing a voice as though from the outside, but it's a voice that no one else around me could hear. And so then he told me about his son, who also heard voices. And he said that his son was very disturbed by this because the voices were very, you know, were very harsh and very cruel to him. And so he found this, you know, he found this experience very, very disturbing, which of course he would. And so that also got me thinking about the harsh, disturbing internal voices that I think we all feel. And certainly artists and writers feel them a lot, you know, the voices right. that are telling us that, you know, whatever it is that we're writing just really sucks. And we should probably, you know, stop writing and get a good, get a job. Right. And so this started me thinking about the, you know, the range of voices and how we hear them. You know, some voices, you know, we look at as creative inspiration. Some voices we, you know, experience as the voice of the inner critic, right? Some voices we experience as external, you know, as the voice of the external critic. But it, again, it's an unshared experience that, you know, that others around can't hear. And so I started thinking about this and I started thinking, you know, when is a voice normal? And when is it inspired? And when is it neurotic? And when is it considered to be psychotic, right? When is it problematic? And I started to think about this range and to think about, you know, well, you know, where in this spectrum does normal lie? And is there some way of expanding what, you know, what we consider to be normal? Because normal, of course, is a social construct like anything else.
One of the things I love about that is Benny is such a typical teenager in his reaction to the voices, because, you know, will you just leave me alone? Will you stop? Come on. And which is such a common reaction. And yet he then, as I mentioned, is diagnosed with a mental disorder. And it feels as though not only the diagnosis, but the treatment really misunderstand who he is, what he's going through, and that experience.
I think that's true. And, you know, here I can once again relate this to, you know, a personal experience. When I was maybe a little older than Benny, when I was a teenager, I also had, you know, an experience where I was committed to a locked psychiatric ward for, you know, a period of time. You know, it was an experience that was very traumatic. The entire time I was there, I was thinking, this is just wrong. There's something wrong here. This is not what should be happening. There are other ways that, you know, that I could be getting help, you know, for what ailed me. And so this led me to, you know, and also my inquiry into voice hearing, my curiosity about voice hearing, this experience, led me to some wonderful, you know, groups. For example, there's a website that you can find called Intervoice, and it's the international voice hearing community. And there's also a USA branch of this, and it's a wonderful sort of peer support group that is looking at the experience, these unshared experiences, and trying to come up with ways of helping people who are disturbed by this, you know, these unshared experiences that they're having. It's an alternative method of dealing with what is often a problem, because very often voice hearing is not a problem. You know, I mean, there are lots of people who hear voices who are not bothered by them. Oddly enough, you know, and ironically enough, you know, Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung, you know, the fathers of psychology, both talked about hearing voices. You know, Mahatma Gandhi, you know, heard voices. You know, certainly Joan of Arc heard voices. You know, it's not as uncommon as one would think.
Ruth Ezeki is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the new novel is The Book of Form and Emptiness. We read this book as from two perspectives. One is, of course, Benny, who is telling his story, and then the book, which is the actual book that is conversing with Benny, right? They are having a conversation throughout the course of the novel.
That's right. That's right. The book is the narrator of the novel. You know, the book is the narrator of itself, in other words.
You write very early on from the book's perspective, stories never start at the beginning, Benny. They differ from life in that regard. Life is lived from birth to death, from the beginning into an unknowable future. But stories are told in hindsight. Stories are life lived backward. Were you always aware of that in the construct of the novel?
Yes, I was. And I played with it in various ways. You know, so for example, the book starts with a death, right? It starts with the death of Benny's father. And this is really the traumatizing event that, you know, that precipitates, everything that follows. But, you know, after we read a little bit about, you know, the death and the funeral and, you know, the cremation, Benny interrupts the book's narration at that point and says, wait, you're skipping all the good stuff. The good stuff happened before, right? And, you know, go back and tell, you know, tell the readers, you know, about how my parents met because they had a beautiful love story, right? And so the Benny from time to time interrupts the book's narration and, you know, insists on, you know, sort of correcting the record.
And that idea of correcting the record also gives us great insight to Benny. But the book is ultimately looking to bring Benny to a place of where he can find some solace.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that the book is really helping Benny sort of navigate these voices that he's hearing. I think he's helping Benny sort of come to terms with his, you know, very fierce inner critic. And, you know, this is all being done, you know, through language, through the medium of words and stories. And, you know, and so this is, well, it's interesting because there's also a psychiatrist, a children's psychiatrist in the book. She tries to do various things and to help. She's not a bad person at all. You know, and in fact, I see her and the book as being, you know, both forces who are trying to help Benny cope with his voices. But, you know, I think that in certainly, you know, in the story, in this context, the story of this novel, and also in the context of my life, too, you know, really the thing that saved me was books. You know, it was books and writing and, you know, writing stories and reading stories and, you know, having this, you know, this connection to worlds that were, you know, bigger than mine, you know, and so in that sense, it's really kind of an homage to the, you know, to the importance of books for young people.
There's a beautiful passage early on in the book. Again, it's from the book's perspective. Human language is a clumsy tool. People have such a hard time understanding each other. So how can you even begin to imagine the subjectivities of animals and insects and plants, never mind pebbles and sand? It's a beautiful thought because we have enough trouble trying to figure out what we're saying to each other, much less anything else.
Exactly. No, and I think part of the problem is that we don't listen. You know, we don't expect, you know, pebbles and sand or, you know, trees, you know, birds, animals to speak to us. You know, obviously they don't speak English, right? They don't speak human language. But they, you know, I do believe, and this is where I think my Zen, and maybe it's not even Zen, it's more my Japanese heritage comes in. You know, I believe that these other non-human persons are, you know, are teachers. They can be our teachers, you know, if we listen to them, you know, but in, you know, our culture, we're not really taught to do that.
And that's what's fascinating about this, because as Benny Hsu is talking to him, it that can be seen as from the outside world as, you know, that, okay, he has an issue. There's a problem there, mm-hmm. but you can learn from that experience if you listen to it. You said mm-hmm. a moment ago that you were saved by books, but the fact of being a Zen Buddhist priest, did the two come together as being eventually being one, not just separate pursuits, but I am a writer and I am a Zen Buddhist priest?
Yeah, that's a great question because, you know, at first I did think of them, you know, and I experienced them as being separate. There was the writing thing that I did on one side, and then there was the Zen thing that I did on the other side. And then, of course, the longer that I did both, the more they merged. And these days I don't really see a, you know, I don't see that much difference between them. Obviously, you know, when I'm sitting zazen, when I'm meditating, you know, I don't usually have a pencil in my hand. You know, so it's, you know, the props are different and the activity is different, sure. But, you know, I think that the Zen Buddhism, you know, it's nothing special. It's not like this special thing that's separate from anything else. It just, you know, Zen Buddhism is, in a way, just explains things as they are, right? Just explains the world, you know, and represents the world as it is. And so, you know, I think that, you know, really, if you look at, I mean, take an example of, you know, the Zen principle, right? The Buddhist principle of impermanence, right? Well, that's certainly not something that is, you know, that Zen has any monopoly on, right? It's not like, you know, people who practice Buddhism are, you know, impermanent, whereas people who don't practice Buddhism are permanent. You know, we know that that's not the case, right? You know, it's just a description of, you know, it's a sort of description of, you know, the world as it is, reality as it is, right? And I think that's, you know, another principle, for example, is interconnectedness, right? You know, the fact that we can't, as human beings, you know, live on this earth without, you know, trees and plants and animals and air and rain and, you know, sun and, you know, the whole, you know, the whole thing, right? We're radically interconnected with everything else. And that's not Zen. That's just reality. So, you know, looked at from, you know, in that way, you know, I would say that all literature, you know, any story that is told, is Buddhist, right? Because it's all about, you know, any novel is about connection. Any novel is about impermanence. Any novel is about suffering, right? These are all just, it's all just the human experience. So in that sense, I kind of don't think that the, you know, that the Zen Buddhism part is, you know, it helps me, but it's not, it doesn't, I don't think, make my novels sort of different or special in any kind of way.
It is interesting, though, because you have a Zen Buddhist nun in this novel. You had one in your last
True.
novel.
That's right.
And that's a helpful bridge of understanding and kind of putting all the pieces together for the
Yeah.
reader.
And you're right. I mean, I think I'm being a little disingenuous, you know, when I say that, because these last two novels, certainly do have overtly, you know, Zen Buddhist characters in them. And there is, you know, very much, you know, I'm sort of pulling the Zen themes, as it were, to the surface. You know, and that, so that's absolutely true. I'm not sure whether I'll continue to do that. I don't feel bound to do that in any way. And I'm pretty sure that the next book, you know, will not do that. But it's been a, I see the A Tale for the Time Being and the Book of Form and Emptiness as being a kind of pair. The first book, A Tale for the Time Being, sort of explored Zen questions about time. And this book, The Book of Form and Emptiness, is exploring Zen questions about space, right? And so in that sense, you know, I see them as kind of a pair. But, you know, in the same way that my first two books were both books about food and food production, right? So I seem to work in pairs somehow. It wasn't planned, but that seems to be what's happening.
Ruth Ezeki is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel is The Book of Form and Emptiness. There's a wonderful character, the Aleph, who is in this novel and is a bit of a love interest for Benny, although older and certainly has her own set of issues. Talk a little bit about that character because a fascinating character that, yes, is flawed, but has also really got her stuff together.
Yeah, she's an interesting character. You know, I'm trying to remember where she came from. She was actually, she and the bottle man, who is another character, one of the denizens of the library, you know, where Benny goes to hang out. He sort of seeks refuge in the library. And they were both refugees from an early draft of A Tale for the Time Being, as was the library. You know, at one point in the you know, the construction of that book, the writing of that book, half of the book took place in a library, and you know, the Aleph and the Bottle Man were both characters there. And I eventually, you know, I had to cut them out of there because I had to reconceive the entire book at one point. And those two characters just refused to die. You know, they mm-hmm. they just did not want to go off quietly into, you know, wherever characters go. And so I ended up, you know, sort of having to create a new fictional world for them. So you could say in a way that, you know, that those two characters were almost the genesis of this book. She's a, you know, she's an interesting character in the sense that, yes, she is flawed and she has her issues. But she's, you know, she really helps Benny. She's perhaps the, you know, the person who understands him the best, and who is able to help him in the way that peers can help us, right? The name, of course, comes from the Borges story, right. The Aleph, and you know, and it's the, you know, in the Borges story, the Aleph is not a you know, is not a person. It's a phenomenon. It's the point in space that contains all of space, all points in space, right? And so, you know, this is a nickname that the Bottle Man has given her, and she has that, you know, she has that to me anyway, that quality, right, of having sort of unknown facets, or just, you know, she kind of contains everything in a way. Certainly for Benny, she does, right? Because he's madly in love with her. So yeah, it was fun to write her. She was a fun character to write.
She's also a defender of the Bottle Man. I mean, these are people who are sort of cast aside, and yet even Benny doesn't know quite what to make of the Bottle Man. And yet the Aleph is really his fiercest defender.
Yes, that's right. Well, the Bottle Man is a, you know, he's a homeless Slovenian poet philosopher who has lost a leg and rides around in a wheelchair. And he is one of the denizens of the library, and he holds, you know, literary salons in the, you know, the men's washroom. And, you know, so he and the Aleph have a, and he's also the person who's protected her when she was, you know, when she was young and living on the streets. And he has a similar function with Benny. I mean, because he's a poet and because he's a philosopher, he's really one of the characters who can help Benny learn to listen to the voices inside him and to relate to them differently. So he's a really crucial character in that regard.
So let us end with the subject of libraries, because libraries play such a crucial role in this novel. And being the only place that Benny can find shelter from the voices in his head, and where he finds these people and feels, not only does he find safety, but a librarian helps save his mom as well.
Yes, that's right. Well, there's a children's librarian who is a character in the book. She's a bit of a superhero, you know, because, I mean, you know, obviously she's a librarian, right? All librarians are superheroes.
Yes, they are.
yes, Benny, you know, he gravitates towards the library, really. Well, it's the Aleph who, you know, gives him the clue and, you know, sort of gets him to the library. But he finds it very soothing because, of course, the library is a place filled with talking objects. You know, books speak to us, of course, but the books in the library, you know, are kind of all, you know, they know their place, right? They know their places, and they're lined up quietly, and they speak in their library voices. And so he finds it to be a very soothing place, as, you know, opposed to the sort of cacophony of the, you know, outside, you know, consumer capitalist world that we live in, right? And so he's, you know, he's happy there, and he's able to, you know, he's able to learn things, he's able to hear things there. And in fact, that's where he meets his book, because obviously that's where books hang out. And so he, you know, he meets his book in a location in the basement of the library, and this is the defunct bindery. It's an old bindery that is being dismantled. So it's filled with, you know, blank sheets of paper and paper cutters and sewing machines and all of the tools and paraphernalia needed to bind books. And it's a place of unbound words, right? It's a place that's filled with unbound words. So it's a place of where anything can happen. And that's where Benny hears the first few lines of the book. And that's where he, that's, you know, where he meets the book for the first time.
There's this wonderful part that you write, a repository housing the bound testimony of mankind's mortal fears and immortal yearnings ought to be a solid, reassuring sort of place, harmonious and reliably symmetrical, built in such a way as to make even the most disquieted patron feel safe and secure. But architects and city planners concerned with ensuring their own immortality have other ideas. They see the library as a legacy project and books as mere props, a motley assortment of mismatched objects that mar the clean lines of their design aesthetic. Man, that says a lot.
Well, okay, so the book has very, very strong opinions about what libraries should and should not be. You know, now I'm not going to claim that those are my opinions, mind you, but the, you know, the book really has, you know, has thoughts about this. You know, and I have to admit, I also have noticed that it seems like the more glass, you know, is used in a library, the fewer books there are. So, it, you know, these observations have you know, occurred to me as well.
Yeah. The name of the new novel is The Book of Form and Emptiness. What a beautiful novel. I thank you so much for being with us. I thank you even more for writing it and sharing it with us. Ruth Ezeki, it's a great pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much, Joe.
Ruth Ezeki's new novel is The Book of Form and Emptiness. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.